Okay, looks good. Welcome everybody to Bio 231. It's Wednesday, October 21st. And anybody have any questions over what we covered last time? Because I turned some lights off. We were talking about central nervous system last time, and we're going to finish up central nervous system today and move into peripheral nervous system. So let's see what time we have left. Looking at the schedule, indeed today is the 21st, right here, peripheral nervous system. So we're still right on schedule. That's amazing. Let's see, in one and a half weeks away, this is the next practicum. Right, so those of you, I think there's only one more lab. Unless you have lab afternoons on Wednesday, then there's two labs left. All right, so one more lab and then a lab practicum. There are three labs, or two and a half, because the lab at the end of the second practicum wasn't all that long. And then on the last practicum, there's going to be four labs. And after this week, every lab is going to entail a dissection. And remember, when we do a dissection, you have to bring hand protection, eye protection, and toe protection. And if you want to bring a mouth guard, that's fine with me. By that, I mean a mask. All right, and in lab, we'll discuss toe protection, eye protection, hand protection, but probably not right now. All right, well, when is your next lecture exam? Next one is going to be on a Monday, and it is 1, 2, 3 and a half weeks, 3 and a half weeks away. But there's a Veterans Day holiday in there, so it's really like 3 weeks away. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody got a question about schedule? We're good? Okay. Good. I'll put that away. And let's start finishing up central nervous system. I do believe I showed you this slide before. I wish I could make it a little bit bigger without losing my cursor, but I can't, so I'm just going to make it bigger anyway. All right, so the central nervous system made up of brain and spinal cord, and we got all the way down to spinal cord. We've got to talk about just a few more things. Remember, right at the foramen magnum, that's the origin of the spinal cord. And it goes down not all the way to the sacrum, but only about to the level of L2, which is what I see right here. Right. And that's because the neuronal tissue of the spinal cord can't grow as fast as the rest of a person's body. So it's a lot shorter than the vertebral column. And the spinal cord ends in this conical structure right here. Does this kind of remind you of like an ice cream cone or something? Do you see the tip in the center of the conus medullaris? And that's how it got its name, because it looks like a cone or a wedge. That's the end of the spinal cord, and you're going to see that right around the level of L2. There is fluid between the membranes of the central nervous system and the neuronal tissue, and we call that cerebrospinal fluid. Sometimes it's important to remove some cerebrospinal fluid from a person to see if there's an infection going on there, if it's a bacterial infection or a fungal infection or any kind of infection. And then while they're at diagnosing it, while they're at it, they also try to figure out what kind of treatment they should use. Right, so they'll figure out what kind of antibiotic is very effective with that particular bacteria that they have in their central nervous system, because that's a really terrible place to have an infection. You really have to know ahead of time if how you're going to treat the patient is going to work or not. So you might be wondering, how is it then that nerves go all the way down to the sacrum, because you're familiar with the anterior and posterior sacral foramina? Well, they leave the spinal cord and then they proceed through the vertebral canal as a nerve. And I see a whole bunch of nerves right here. And all these nerves kind of reminded somebody of a horse's tail. All the little hairs coming off the tail. And so that's why they named this thing the cauda equina, which literally means horse's tail. So if we want to get some cerebral spinal fluid, it's a lot safer to put a needle into the intervertebral foramina below the level of L2, because then you don't have to worry about lacerating the spinal cord. Usually these nerves kind of move out of the way when you do that. So insert a needle, aspirate some cerebral spinal fluid out, and you don't have to worry about injuring the spinal cord. Does anybody know what that's called when we remove some spinal, not we, when somebody does? We're not going to do that. when somebody does remove cerebral spinal fluid. What's that called? Oh, wow, you got a lot of different names. Say again? Yeah, spinal tap is good. That's what I would call it. Okay, so those are some important structures, but here's one that's even as important. It's not neuronal tissue, right? But the conus medullaris, if it was just left to sit there by itself, it would eventually retract back up to the brain. It would get pulled back up to the brain, and all these nerves would get stretched and damaged. So there is a ligament that comes from the conus medullaris, attaches itself to the sacrum, and we see it right here. We call that the phylum terminale. That puts a little traction on the spinal cord so it doesn't retract and get damaged. Right? Can you see that the very center piece right here? Looks a little bit darker. That's the phylum terminale. That can be problematic too. For instance, in some people, the conus medullaris adheres to the sacrum. And then as a person grows, that overstretches the spinal cord. That produces neuronal deficits. And that's what's called a tethered cord. Right? If that's happening, then that adhesion has to be removed and allow the spinal cord to start growing normally. So those are some of the major pieces in this region and why it's important to know the names of these pieces. Right? Taking spinal taps, making sure that the spinal cord grows at the proper rate. When we look at the spinal cord, I see that there are some areas that are very thin and in some areas that are thick. Right? The thicker areas are what we call enlargements. And where is the spinal cord the thinnest, at least at the part that we're looking at right here on the slide? Can you tell? How about cervical region? What about lumbar region? What about thoracic region? Would you say any one of those? Somebody got to tell me. Yeah, the thoracic region. Look how narrow it is right here. I just want to make sure that I'm showing you the slides so I don't have to look around behind me. And then in the cervical region and lumbar region, then we have these enlargements. And let's think about why these enlargements are there. Does anybody have a good guess as to why we have these two places for enlargements of the spinal cord? Because you have something special up here that you don't have in the thoracic region. You have this appendage. You have upper appendages and you have lower appendages. And to help control those appendages, you need more neurons, and in particular, something else, these appendages are involved with reflexes. So if there's a damaging stimulus picked up by your fingertip that comes into the spinal cord, and the spinal cord can make a decision on what to do about that damaging stimulus that's being applied to your body before you even know about it. We call that a reflex. And all those reflexes are just neuronal circuits that are contained in these cervical enlargements. And since we don't have any appendages in the thoracic region, there really is not a lot of reflex activity in that region. Okay, so that's the purpose of those enlargements, cervical and lumbar enlargements. All right, I want to go and find another good picture of spinal cord. Okay, this is a pretty good picture. So it's just a nice transverse section. And what kind of vertebrae does this remind you of? Cervical, because of the transverse foramina, because of the bifid spinous process, right? All right, and then so here is the vertebral foramen with spinal cord on the inside of it, filling it up. And let me zoom into this region right here. I can see a lot of structures. I can't recall if this is an exam figure, but it might be a good one. Does anybody know if this is an exam figure? I don't think it is. Probably next semester I'll make it an exam figure. All right, so here is the spinal cord. When you look at the spinal cord, I see a letter of the alphabet, which is an H, okay? And what kind of matter makes up the H? You got two choices, gray or white. And it's gray, yeah, because it's darker. And what can you tell me about the characteristic of gray matter? What kinds of pieces of a neuron are in gray matter? Myelinated axons or cell bodies and dendrites? Just cell bodies and dendrites. They're not myelinated, so they don't look white. And so this area that's deep in the spinal cord, this is gray matter filled with nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And these are just special communication centers that can run reflexes without your conscious control. So there's a lot of signal processing taking place in the gray matter of the spinal cord. And tell me something about white matter. White matter is superficial on the spinal cord. And what part of a neuron makes up white matter? Axons that are myelinated in particular, because myelin has that white appearance. It's a lipid. It's a fat. All right, so these are axons, and axons take information long distances. Some of those axons are bringing information up to the brain. Some axons are bringing information down from the brain. And, of course, they have two different functions. Tell me something about the function of an axon that's bringing information up to the brain. We call that an ascending tract. What's the purpose of an ascending tract? Ascending. Okay, if we classify a neuron by its function, there are two ways. Anybody remember? Motor or sensory, afferent or efferent. So those are your choices. There's only two. So ascending tracts, are they afferent or efferent? If they're ascending, they're bringing information into the brain, so they are afferent, afferent tracts. Tracts that take information down from the brain eventually are going to end up in the periphery. Those are what we call efferent tracts or motor tracts. So that's a really convenient way to think of the nervous system, either by motor control or sensory control. Right? So sensory or afferent, motor, and efferent. The arrangement of gray matter and white matter is different in the spinal cord than the cerebrum. Because remember, on the cerebrum, gray matter was in the cortex of the brain, and the white matter was deeper. That's not so in the spinal cord. The gray part is not superficial. It is deep inside the spinal cord. Okay, and over here, this yellow thing, this is what we call a spinal nerve. And a spinal nerve interacts with the spinal cord in two different ways. Right? There's an efferent way and an afferent way. And what is afferent once again? Sensory, okay? So these things that are communicating with the spinal cord are what we call roots. And I see two roots on either side. And a root is either motor or sensory, but not both. And this one right over here where I have the cursor, you don't see a whole lot of the vertebrae, but which one would this one be? Would this be the ventral or dorsal? Dorsal. It's the one in the back, because here I see the spinous process. So this is the dorsal root, which means this is the ventral root. So there are only these two roots. And it just so happens that the ventral root is 100% motor. It's carrying electrical signals away from the spinal cord. The dorsal root is 100% sensory. It's bringing information into the spinal cord. And there's no other way to do that. I see an enlargement, right, in the dorsal root. And there's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in this bulge right here. This is not in the central nervous system. This thing is in the peripheral nervous system. Can anybody remember what a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites is called in the peripheral nervous system? I'll give you a hint. In the central nervous system, it's called a nucleus. In the peripheral nervous system, it's called a ganglion. Yeah, I saw some people saying this. So this is what we call the dorsal root ganglia, or ganglion. And what's the function of this dorsal root ganglion? Is it motor or sensory? Because it's part of the dorsal root, right? It is sensory. And if you look at the different kinds of neurons by shape, the neurons that we have in here are those pseudo-unipolar neurons. So the cell body is here, and then there is a central process that goes to the spinal cord. There's a peripheral process that goes out to the periphery. So you just might want to look at that unipolar neuron or pseudo-unipolar neuron at some point in time to remind yourself. All right, so that is a little bit of an introduction to the spinal cord. It's got these roots, and the function is either motor or sensory. They're never mixed. If there is a nerve that's carrying information both directions, we call that a mixed nerve. So take a look at this. Here is the dorsal root. Here's the ventral root. And they do come together right in this region. This is what we call a spinal nerve. So what's the function of a spinal nerve? Is it motor Is it sensory or is it mixed? It, this particular case, right, it's mixed because it's carrying both. But of course, remember, one neuron can only take information one direction. So there are some neurons that are pointing this way and some that are pointing the opposite direction in this nerve. This is what we call a spinal nerve. Take a guess. Why do we call this a spinal nerve? Because it is coming out of the spine in particular, right? So that's all there's to that, a spinal nerve. All right, I do see some layers around the spinal cord, and there are a number of membranes that surround the central nervous system. We call them the meninges. The outermost layer of the meninges is real tough. It's almost like shoe leather. It's a lot thinner, and actually it's a lot tougher than leather. And we call that the dura mater. Dura means durable, so that really protects our central nervous system. It's really, really tough. When we do a brain dissection in lab, we might have some dura mater on the brains that we're using, and you'll have to remove it, and it's hard because it's really tough. All right, the next deepest layer is what we call the arachnoid. It's a part of the meninges, just like the dura mater, not quite as tough, all right, but it's another layer. And then I see a little space, and then I see the third layer right on the surface of the central nervous system, in this case right on the surface of the spinal cord, and that's called the pia mater. So the pia just means thin, and so those are the three membranes that make the meninges. You have dura mater, arachnoid, and pia mater, or you could say matter if you wanted to. Right, and I mentioned that there is a space between the arachnoid and the pia mater, and since it's underneath the arachnoid, we call this the subarachnoid space, and that subarachnoid space is filled with cerebrospinal fluid. We're going to get to see where that comes from in just a little bit. All right, so that is, oh, that's almost good. Then outside of the dura mater, here is a space in the vertebral foramen, and it's filled with adipose tissue. Otherwise, it would just be an empty space, and your body just never has space inside of it that it doesn't use. And in this particular case, it's used for storing energy in the form of lipid. And since it is above the dura, this is what we call the epidural space. Does that make sense? If it's sitting on top of the dura, epidural means right on top of the dura mater. And for instance, if we wanted to anesthetize the axons in this particular region in somebody's back, somebody can inject anesthesia into the epidural space, and then that will prevent nerve impulses from transiting this part of the spinal cord. And that's really handy because anesthesia is definitely dangerous, right? And there's side effects. And so the more that you can localize and prevent anesthetics from getting all over the body, the better. So you can have a nice block of the spinal cord to prevent the perception of pain, and it's just localized so that that particular patient doesn't have to receive what we call systemic anesthesia, which can be really hard to deal with. And you need to specially train people to do that. Okay, because if you don't, a person can die. Who's one of the one famous person that died fairly recently? Okay, because a doctor wasn't watching him when he was on some pretty powerful pharmaceutical agents. Yeah, Michael Jackson in particular, right? Didn't even seem like the doctor was in the room at the time. That was pretty terrible. All right, so that shot that's used to put anesthetic into the epidural space commonly is called an epidural, right? And that's the reason why. Okay, so it just prevents the necessary use of a systemic anesthetic. Okay, epidurals are used for parturition, and when an epidural is used, right, the baby doesn't experience any anesthesia, which is really good, right? But the mom does. If a mom was given systemic anesthesia, then the baby would be anesthetized as well. And any kind of anesthesia is really terrible on the heart, respiratory system, and so it's a perfect application for that kind of anesthesia. All right, so I'm kind of done talking about this slide. Anybody have a question about this slide? You know, dorsal root, ventral root, the function of the roots, and the spinal nerve. Okay, here's a quiz. what's the function of this spinal nerve? It's called a spinal nerve because it's leaving the spinal cord, so it's a spinal nerve. What's the function of a spinal nerve? It's mixed. Yeah, it's mixed, right? So there has both efferent and afferent axons going through it. All right, let's see what maybe we want to look at next. Okay, let me find another picture of spinal cord. This one here is an exam figure. Okay. All right, so it's a nice transverse section. I can see all the three layers of the meninges and the subarachnoid space. I can see the dorsal and ventral roots very nice. So here is the ventral root. What's the function of this ventral root once again? It's motor, right? Dorsal root is 100% sensory. So this dorsal root ganglia is a sensory ganglion. I can see the gray matter. And the gray matter has different projections coming off of them. And typically we call these horns. All right, so here would be the lateral horn. That makes perfect sense. And since here's the ventral root, this is called the ventral horn. And then over here is the dorsal horn. That's how we talk about these things very nice. There is some gray matter that connects both the right and left horns of the gray matter of the spinal cord. And we call that the gray commissure. And it would be really nice if you knew what this term commissure stands for. What does commissure mean? A commissural tract, for instance, or gray matter, commissural gray matter in the spinal cord. Has to do with sending information. Anybody recall? We talked about it last time. A commissural tract, or structure like the gray commissure, is taking information from one side of the central nervous system to the other side. Right? So a commissure shares information from right to left. Not up and down, not from different places within one side, but completely from the right side to the left side. And for reflexes, that might be pretty important. For instance, if you grab something that's really hot or painful with one hand, the spinal cord right here is going to make you drop that object. It's going to relax muscles in the arm that you pick that object up at, right? So it's going to inhibit muscles on one side of the body. But on the other side of the body, it might cause muscles to contract, like to push yourself away from that object, right? So this is a way that that information can be shared between the right and left sides of the spinal cord to produce some kind of perfect coordinated activity, the gray commissure. And then I see a little hole right here. That's the central canal. That's filled with cerebrospinal fluid as well. We'll kind of put that all together in just a little bit. So we see the horns. And we see that white matter that's superficial in the spinal cord. We could call these things columns because they're either taking ascending tracts up to the brain or descending tracts down to the periphery. And I kind of like to use columns. This figure is labeled funiculus. So funiculus and column are exactly the same thing. And there's basically three kinds. Here's the dorsal column, here's the lateral column, and here is the ventral column. And these are just carrying information up and down the spinal cord. All right, so let's review the brain. What part of the brain is responsible for initiating somatic motor function or control of skeletal muscle? What part, what lobe of the brain is responsible for that? That's great. I don't know if you guys heard it in the back or can remember, but it is the frontal lobe. In particular, right, the precentral gyrus. The architecture of the spinal cord matches that of the brain. So if the anterior lobe is responsible for motor activity, the anterior part of the spinal cord mostly is carrying motor tracts, which means descending tracts. And the posterior part mostly have sensory tracts. It's not 100% that way, but it's mostly that way. So when you think of the frontal lobe, think of the motor in your car. Right, because that helps you understand something about the spinal cord as well. Same kind of architecture. All right, so here I have that spinal nerve, and these things aren't labeled on the slide, so I'm not going to mention it. But we got a little couple pieces right here that we got to talk about eventually. All right, so how are we doing so far? Pretty good? Not too complicated. I don't want to look at that one. Oh, here's something about a spinal tap. Okay. All right, let me go back to the word slide. Tracts, I was talking about tracts, either ascending tracts or ascending or descending tracts. So let me find a spinal cord that have, oh, here, wonderful. There are a lot of different kinds of tracts, and I want you to become a little bit familiar with two of them. Okay? One is going to be ascending, the other is going to be descending, just as an example. And think of a muscle, for instance. Some muscles, like the coracobrachialis, have the origin and insertion in the name. So what is the origin of the coracobrachialis? It's the coracoid process. Right? And then the brachium is the insertion, which is the humerus. It's another name for humerus. And so which is the origin of the coracobrachialis? Is it the coracoid process or the humerus? Yeah, remember, it's the first part of that word is the origin. The second part is the insertion. And we're going to use that same kind of nomenclature to know something about tracts, like spinal thalamic tract. Where is the thalamus? Is it in the brain or is it in the spinal cord? It's in the brain. It's really high up in the brain. And spinal refers to spinal cord, right? So the spine is the origin, and it ends up in the thalamus. So is that an afferent or efferent tract? Okay, since it's going into the brain, it is afferent. It's sensory. So spinal thalamic tract, right? You know a lot about it just because of the name, right? Comes from the spine, goes into the thalamus. You know that is a sensory tract. And let's see if I can find the spinal thalamic tract. Okay, maybe not here. Ah, here's a slide. This may be an exam figure. I'm not really sure. All right, so here we have somebody's foot, and here we have somebody's hand. Ah, let's just start here at the foot. And let's do something other than just tickle it. Let's put a flame underneath it, like a match. What kind of stimulus is this match on the pedal surface of this foot? Is it tickling or is it damaging? It's a damaging stimulus, right? So your body should know about that so it can remove this appendage from that damaging stimulus. So information is picked up by these temperature receptors, right? The stimulus is heat, the receptor is temperature, and then it enters the central nervous system via what kind of neuron? An afferent neuron or sensory neuron, right? And it always goes in the dorsal root. Here's the dorsal root ganglion, and I can even see that little cell body of this pseudo unipolar neuron right there. And so it enters the dorsal root, and that's where it stops, right? In that dorsal horn of the spinal cord, and it synapses on another neuron. Right? So the sensory neuron is number one. The one that's in the spinal cord is number two, and it ascends all the way to the brain via the lateral spinal thalamic tract, meaning starting in the spine, ending up in the thalamus. All right, so it goes right to here. What do we call this gray matter? Pretty much right smack in the middle of the brain. I see a bit of third ventricle here. Here's a corpus callosum. It's a commissural tract. But what about, let's get back to this gray area here. Not that we don't know enough about it, it just looks gray, is what I mean. This is the thalamus. Anybody remember what the function of the thalamus was in one word? Relay station. And look what it's doing. It's taking the second order neuron and allowing it to synapse on a third order neuron. Right? And these third order neurons take that information to the proper location within the cerebral cortex. And in this particular case, since it's sensory information, you should be able to tell me the gyrus that this information is going to. It's called the primary somatosensory cortex. Can anybody remember what the primary somatosensory cortex is? What about motor? What lobe is motor controlled? Frontal lobe. Sensory then is parietal lobe on either side of the central sulcus. So this is the postcentral gyrus right here. It's receiving information from the surface of your body. So that's the postcentral gyrus, that is the primary somatosensory cortex. All right, so in order for you to have somatic sensation, how many nerves does it take to get from the sensor to your brain where you can appreciate it? I see one, I see two, and I see three. First order, second order, third order neurons, right? And What kind of tract is a spinal thalamic tract? A couple of different ways you could talk about it. Sensory, yeah? What's another way of saying sensory if it's a tract in the spinal cord? It is ascending. An ascending tract is sensory. All right, so here is an example of a ascending tract. I also want to quickly show you the corticospinal tract. So where do signals originate for the corticospinal tract? The cortex, because it tells you right there. And where do they end up? Spinal cord. So let me see if I can find a corticospinal tract. All right, here it is right here. All right, so I see some cell bodies, gray matter, in the brain, the cerebrum. And as a matter of fact, you should be able to tell me what gyrus the cell body is in. What is the gyrus that's responsible for initiating contraction of skeletal muscle? It's not the motor area, or is it the motor area? If it's going to control this effector organ, the skeletal muscle, it's got to be motor. Okay? And what cortex, what lobe of the brain do you know that's motor? Yeah, the frontal. So the precentral gyrus is right here. Right? If we were to stimulate this particular gyrus, then that information would flow down to a muscle and cause contraction of a particular muscle. And if we move over, then it would be a different muscle in a little different part of the body. And where you would know what muscle contracts, you would just look at that homuncular diagram that we looked at last time. Right? You could superimpose that little body right on the cortex of the brain and know what area it's responsible. Remember, like, face was over here, tongue was right down below it, hand was above the face, like that, really big areas. Okay, so since this is the cortical spinal tract, the first neuron originates from that precentral gyrus, and here's that axon, and it's myelinated, so when it's in this region, what color is the brain going to be? It's going to be white, right? So here's some white matter in the cerebrum. It moves between the thalamus and the basal nuclei, and here is, right? These are just all tracts that are myelinated, so it's a nice myelinated area for tracts, and as a matter of fact, mostly descending tracts right through here. This is the internal capsule. I don't know if I have anything at the end of the chapter or the exam study guide for internal capsule. I don't know. I suspect maybe I do because I'm remembering it right now. Okay, internal capsule between the thalamus and basal ganglia. It's a motor tract, gets down into the spinal cord. Sometimes these neurons, and it's still the same neuron, sometimes these neurons cross over to the other side of the spinal cord and it makes a crisscross look, okay, on the medulla. So this is the level of the medulla, and sometimes it has these cross hatch markings on it, and since they cross over each other, they have a point, and it looks like a pyramid, and so sometimes this region of the medulla we call the pyramids, and this is where motor neurons cross over to the other side of the body, and then they descend, right, to where they're going to exit the spinal cord. Well, I'm going to have to zoom into this region. Okay. So now it has crossed over, and its synapses in the gray matter, and here is a really short neuron before it stimulates the third somatic motor neuron to the skeletal muscle. Anybody remember what this little dinky short neuron is called? That's an interneuron. Yeah, somebody knew that. Or association neuron. So interneurons are found completely within the central nervous system. They're not any part of them is in the peripheral nervous system. Like this neuron right here that's going to skeletal muscle, this particular voluntary effector organ. All right, so here is a motor neuron. What route does it use to get out to the periphery? Can you see that on this figure? What route? Which route has this bulge? Dorsal root. So this is the ventral root. And remember, ventral root is 100% motor, and indeed this is a motor neuron because it's going to the skeletal muscle, so we're not violating any principles at all, right? It makes perfect sense. All right, so this is the corticospinal tract. Right, you probably have some questions or something about this particular tract in your exam study guide. Okay. Let's look at reflexes. I think we looked at reflexes already, but let's just talk about it now since we've gone over it a couple times. And I think that's in a different chapter. All right, so I'm not going to show you a picture. Right, but we should know all the parts of a reflex or a response loop. Right? And a response loop always starts with a stimulus. And notice, I don't know who made these notes, but notice it's not listed here. Right? So you should jot that down. Stimulus starts a reflex or a response loop or a reflex arc. And a stimulus can only be appreciated by your body if it has a... What does your body have to have to that particular stimulus? Maybe it's a light stimulus. Maybe, yeah, or a temperature stimulus, or an obnoxious stimulus, right? You need to have a receptor. And we call that a sensory receptor. And how does that information get into the central nervous system? Via the sensory neuron. What's another name for sensory neuron? Afferent, perfect, afferent neuron. And how does that information enter the spinal cord? Via which root? Dorsal root, passes by the ganglion first, dorsal root, and then it's going to stimulate a neuron that's completely within the spinal cord. We call that an association neuron. And when that information is shared between various association neurons, then the spinal cord can actually make a decision for you. It can actually tell an appendage what to do. Like if it's a painful stimulus that's being stimulated, it's going to cause a withdrawal reflex. Even without your knowledge, the spinal cord can think for you. And it's going to send information to skeletal muscle out of the spinal cord. And to leave, it's got to go through a root. And you should know what root it leaves by. What? How would a signal, nerve signal, get out of the spinal cord? Which root would it use? The ventral root. You seem a little tentative with that. Yes, the ventral root is motor. Remember, dorsal root is sensory. And if I haven't taught this class in like 15 years or something, I probably still could remember with a little trick. Should I tell you this little trick? If you guys are going to groan when I tell you. You might not even be able to use it. It's so silly. But anyway, okay, sensory has a nice S in it, and dorsal also has an S. Okay, and motor has a T, and guess what root has a T in it? Ventral. Okay, so at least that matches up in my mind a little bit, right? That might help you at least get through the lecture exam before you forget. Okay, so ventral root is motor, and dorsal is sensory. That's if you need to stop and think of it. After a while, you don't have to stop and think about it. All right, so that neuron then takes information to skeletal muscle. And what kind of neuron takes information from the central nervous system to that skeletal muscle? That is an efferent or motor neuron, right? And of course that leaves the ventral root and it goes to a skeletal muscle. In this particular case, that skeletal muscle generally is going to be called an effector organ. And I don't know who made this list up right here, but an effector organ always produces what? A response, right? So jot that down on your list. So this reflex always starts with a stimulus, ends in a response, and you got to have all these little pieces in between. And we've talked about this already. Meninges. I think I've talked about the meninges pretty much. All I need to talk about them. Except there is an exam figure, which I don't think I've gone over. So let's make a couple of exam figures. All right, here's one. So this is just a chunk of brain and some skull and some skin taken out of this little illustration right here. And here is the longitudinal sulcus, which separates the cerebral hemispheres. And I see it right here. Right? And on the surface of the central nervous system, no matter if it's spinal cord or brain, there are meninges that protect that really delicate soft tissue. And can anybody remember what the outermost part of the meninges is? It's got a name all by itself. It's the tough one. So it is the dura mater, right? So let's see if we can find the dura mater first. And as a matter of fact, all right, let's work our way down to it. Here's some skin of the scalp, and then here is the bone. We might want to consider this maybe parietal bone or frontal bone. There's a membrane on the surface, cortical surface, the outside surface of bone, Anybody remember the name of that membrane on the outside surface of bone that surrounds the bone on the outside? Yeah, the periosteum. So we got scalp, we got periosteum right on the surface of the skull bone, and I can see some diploe in here, some spongy bone, and then some more cortical bone over here. And then surrounding the bone on this deeper side is going to be another part of the periosteum, right? Periosteum completely surrounds the bone, and it's joined with another layer. And these two layers put together are what we call the dura mater. They're really, really tough. In particular, it's really tough because of this meningeal division of the dura mater. The periosteal is not very tough. Right, so if you really think a dura mater, it's got these two layers to it, and the toughest one is the meningeal layer. There's a membrane deep through the dura mater. Maybe you can remember what it's called. Not nearly as strong as the dura mater. I see it right here. Looks pretty thin. That is the arachnoid. Right, that's part of the meninges. And then the deepest layer, anybody remember what that deepest layer is called? It's a membrane that's right on the surface of the brain, and it attaches itself to the top of every gyrus and the bottom of every sulcus and down through every particular fissure in the brain and every sulcus in the brain. This is a very delicate layer. It's called the, somebody said, yeah, pia mater, right? So those are the three layers once again, dura, arachnoid, and pia. There are some fibers, some connective tissue fibers that connect the arachnoid with the pia mater. We can see them right here. And notice how big that space is between the arachnoid membrane and the pia membrane. It's filled with cerebrospinal fluid, and it's got a special name. It's below the arachnoid, so it's called the subarachnoid space. It's filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, and look at that gray matter on the cortex of the brain, white matter that's deeper. I see some blood vessels outside the brain. The brain itself doesn't have a whole lot of big blood vessels like I see outside of it. Okay, when the pia mater moves over to midline and actually extends all the way down into the brain, separating the hemispheres apart from each other, we call this the falx cerebri. It's just a vertical membrane that separates the two hemispheres. And remember, if brain on the right side is thinking something, it can't move across that longitudinal fissure or through the meninges to get to the other side. How does the other side of the brain know what the first one is thinking? That signal has to go down to the corpus callosum, cross over, and then go back up. Remember, the corpus callosum has those commissural fibers. That's a way of sharing information from right to left. Okay, so this subarachnoid space has what kind of fluid in it? It has cerebrospinal fluid. Where do I have cerebrospinal fluid in my notes? Look at here. All right, the total volume of cerebrospinal fluid in the central nervous system is about 150 milliliters, the total volume. But it's not just sitting there. It's circulating. It's being produced someplace, and then it's being produced. Its fluid is being taken away from the circulatory system, from your blood, and that fluid flows around the brain, and then it's returned to the blood. That total volume is about 150 mLs, and look how much has to be produced every day, 500 mLs. So the cerebrospinal fluid in your brain is recirculated about five times, right? Or is replaced about five times every day. And does anybody know the name of that tissue that makes cerebrospinal fluid? People in the lab this morning, we talked about it. I'm not sure I talked about it in every lab section yet. It's part of the, yeah, that's great. It's part of what's for the quiz for next time, that nice sagittal view of the brain. It's called the choroid plexus. Choroid plexus produces cerebrospinal fluid, and it circulates around the brain. We're going to look at that pattern in just a second. And then, so that you don't dehydrate or lose blood volume, that fluid is returned to the blood via these little arachnoid granulations, or sometimes it's called a villus. So cerebrospinal fluid goes back into the blood, and it looks blue right here because that's a venous blood. A lot of oxygen has been taken out of it. And this is what we call the superior sagittal sinus. So where would we, and a sinus could be a bunch of different kinds of things. It's just a big space. In particular, this big space is filled with blood. And why would we consider this the sagittal sinus? Because it is right on midline. Okay? And it just follows that longitudinal sulcus. All right, so look at this figure. Does anybody have any questions about this figure? Because this is a pretty good exam figure. Don't know if I have it on the test for sure, but it's a pretty good one. Questions? We're okay? Okay, so what else? We promised you we would look about... here's that fault cerebri that separates the right and left cerebral hemispheres within that longitudinal sulcus. Okay. I hope this is an exam figure, but I can't remember for sure. But it's really important because it shows us the pattern of flow of cerebrospinal fluid. So the spinal fluid in your brain sort of acts like a circulatory system, right? The heart isn't pumping it through, right? But it does move around, and maybe we'll talk about why that is in just a little bit. That cerebrospinal fluid is produced by tissue that we call choroid plexus. Right, so I see some choroid plexus in this chamber of the brain, and then way over here that's lateral, and then there's one way down over here by the cerebellum. And cerebrospinal fluid flows from a chamber that is way lateral in the brain, and we call those the lateral ventricles. And then they flow into this chamber, which is what we call the third ventricle, and then it flows into this chamber, which we call the fourth. Right, so third ventricle is inside the thalamus, the fourth is between the pons and the cerebellum. And that's how it flows through the cerebral aqueduct. Once it gets into the fourth ventricle, it can exit through a hole to go into that subarachnoid space that we're kind of familiar with already. Or it can go down through the central canal of the spinal cord, all the way down to the conus medullaris, and then leave the spinal cord. And then it makes its way back up to the brain through that subarachnoid space, right, until it bumps into these arachnoid granulations or villus, and then that cerebrospinal fluid is returned back to the blood so that we don't dehydrate. And remember, this does, that circulation happens about 5 times every day. What else do I want to say about that? Oh, the function, one function of that cerebrospinal fluid. Right? The brain doesn't have any bones in it, doesn't have any ligaments, right, to keep it together, and it's kind of heavy. So what can you tell me about, if we were to weigh you with a scale, like right now, okay, next to your chair, and then put you in a pool, and then you stand on that scale once again, would that scale measure the same weight? No, you'd be a lot lighter when you were floating in the water, right? And so that's part of the job of the cerebrospinal fluid. It helps float the brain in your cranium so that it's not so heavy. If it was really heavy, then the neuronal tissue of the brain would just squish itself. Right, so it helps buoy up the tissue of the brain. The other thing that it does pretty nicely is that if there's trauma to the anterior section of the brain, that force would be transmitted through the cerebrospinal fluid and directed to a lot of different places in the brain, and thereby decreasing the strength of that traumatic event at one location, right? As it travels around, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So it's a way of taking energy from the trauma in one part of the central nervous system and having it dissipate all over the place. So that's another important function. And if you were to look at a modern day helmet from a football player, right, inside that helmet, there are chambers filled with fluid. Sometimes it's air, sometimes it's liquid, or maybe even both, depending on what kind of helmet it is. So, right, even helmet designers are using the design of the brain to help protect the heads of athletes. So that's a very common kind of thing. The other thing that the cerebrospinal fluid is for is that it adjusts the chemical composition that is around the brain. It has glucose, which is a sugar molecule, energy molecule. It can contain oxygen, vitamins, and it also some of these things like sodium and potassium. What can you tell me about sodium and potassium? What kind of beasts are these things? Anybody remember anything about sodium? Do you believe me that Na stands for sodium?
Yes, good. And K stands for? Potassium, right? Okay. And what are these things generally called? Electrolytes, they are ions. And since they're electrolytes, they help balance the electrical properties of the brain. And the sodium, potassium, and even magnesium have to be at the, magnesium is an electrolyte as well, have to be in the proper range, proper concentrations in order for the brain to function. And the choroid plexus helps maintain that. So that's another important function of the choroid plexus. Okay. You know, we're pretty good, except I didn't talk about the ventricles yet. So let me go find picture of the ventricles. We have some pretty good pictures of ventricles. And we got some really good models in lab that we're going to look at. I know we have really good pictures of ventricles. Ah, here it is. Okay. All right, so here is a picture. And these blue areas, these blue volumes right here, represent ventricles deep inside the brain. And this is an anterior view, so right smack in the middle, right, would be a mid-sagittal section through the brain. And we can look at these different chambers or ventricles. What we're familiar with is the thalamus, which would be about in this region here, and then this region here. And between the lobes of the thalamus, we're going to find the third ventricle, which I see. It's really thin. It's long from anterior to posterior, but from right to left, it's pretty thin. Third ventricle. All right. And then down below it is the fourth ventricle between the pons and the cerebellum. And then the connecting tube between the third and the fourth is called the cerebroaqueduct. Right? Cerebroaqueduct. So fluid flows from third into the fourth via cerebroaqueduct. But there are some other ventricles too that you can't see at all on midline, and these are way off to the side. What do we call to the side of our body? Lateral, right? And these used to be called first and second. That's why this one here is called the third, but we don't call those first and second anymore. We call these the lateral ventricles. They're a little bit more complicated, but there is choroid plexus in these as well that makes cerebrospinal fluid. So CSF, or cerebrospinal fluid, flows from lateral ventricles into the third. And how would fluid flow from lateral into the third ventricle? I see the pathway right here. You see a little pathway? What is, in anatomy, what do we call something that's a passageway? A foramen. Yeah. Do you see a foramen anywhere? Interventricular foramen. That's a hole that connects the lateral ventricles with the third, so cerebrospinal fluid flows right through that little hole right there. Okay, let me zoom in to this region. Ah, lateral ventricle, third ventricle, interventricular foramen right there. All right, well, sometimes these foramina get plugged up for whatever reason. Sometimes the cerebral aqueduct gets plugged up, and that disturbs the flow pattern. Right? And as a matter of fact, if the cerebral aqueduct is plugged, the choroid plexus in the third ventricle is going to keep producing cerebrospinal fluid. The choroid plexus in the lateral ventricles are going to keep producing cerebrospinal fluid, but it has no place to go. It just gets stuck in these ventricles. So the ventricles get bigger and bigger and bigger. What happens to the brain when that happens? It gets squished because the brain can't, why can't the brain just get bigger? If the ventricles get bigger. Yeah, our cranium keeps it the same size. It can't, right? So when these things get bigger, it squishes the brain and it destroys the brain. And we know that condition to be called hydrocephalus. Cephalus referring to the head or the brain, and hydro referring to water. You have a pretty good picture of what hydrocephalus looks like. Okay, right here. Pretty much in a newborn, and look at the distended cranium. Okay, I don't know if this individual could live through this condition or not. Now it's easily treated with prenatal care, really easy to diagnose with ultrasound. And if a fetus is diagnosed with hydrocephalus or a plugged up foramen or aqueduct, then guess what? A fetus can be operated on in utero before it's born, and a tube is placed from one of those ventricles, probably down to a vein in the chest or a vein in some other part of the head, and that prevents hydrocephalus. That's pretty cool, right? So surgeries can be done on people inside people. That's pretty amazing, whoever figured that out. All right, let's go back to those ventricles once again. Okay, so we were looking at an anterior view, really nice and easy to see the lateral ventricles. Let's look at a lateral view. Here's a lateral view of the ventricles. So here are the lateral ventricles. Here's the third. There would be that interthalamic adhesion. Third is inside right between the lobes of the thalamus. Here's the fourth ventricle. Right, it's kind of wide from right to left, but it's not very wide from anterior to posterior, so you hardly see it at all. And then here is the connection between the third and the fourth ventricle. That connection between the third and fourth is called the cerebral aqueduct. Okay, so that's part of the ventricular system. I'm going to go back to one more illustration. Now we've been looking at the brain for a little while. The figure for your quiz next time should be starting to make a little bit of sense, more sense. All right, so here it is, the quiz in lab for next time. All right, so what did we learn about this? Spinal cord is way down here. Here's foramen magnum. Then this first bump of the brain is called the medulla. All of this area right here is called the brainstem. Medulla is the most inferior part. So here's brainstem. The second bump above it is the pons. We talked about the function of all these things, so you're going to have to refresh your memory as to what the function is. Then here's the cerebellum. Between the pons and cerebellum is the fourth ventricle. Nice blue color. All right, so let's go above the pons. Here is what we call the midbrain. All right, so remember what the midbrain is made up of. These bumps here that are, we call the corpora quadrigemina, because there's four of them. There's two on one side, two on the other. I talked about the function of those. And this thing, not labeled on this slide, but somewhere you have to know about it. Look in the study guide. It's in lab, you have to know this for sure. This is a bridge between the brainstem and the diencephalon, or the cerebrum. And that bridge is what we call, it's a really weird word. Anybody remember what this really weird word is? It's a peduncle, a peduncle. And since it's taking information to the cerebrum, this is the cerebral peduncle. So these three things make up the midbrain. This is what I wanted to get to. Right, what are the pieces of the midbrain? Cerebral peduncle. And what is this tube right here? Cerebral aqueduct. And then the corpora quadrigemina make up the midbrain. Okay, so that's the last thing that I wanted to mention for central nervous system. All right, so what kind of burning questions do you have for central nervous system? Anybody have? Yes, you're going to have to really speak up. Oh, spell peduncle. P-E-D-U-N-C-L-E. Let's see how I did. Let me see if I can find it pretty fast in a slide right here. Peduncle. More important, well, spelling is important, of course, but just as important, you should know what the function of a peduncle is. And it's a bridge between major parts of the brain, is how you should think of it. So it has tracts that has white matter. Okay. There are peduncles from the pons into the cerebellum, right? These are bridges between the cerebellum and pons. Pons is a relay station for things entering and leaving the cerebellum. And here is a peduncle, right? There are three of them. And in lab, we don't even have to know all three. But here is the spelling of a peduncle, P-E-D-U-N-C-L-E. Okay, peduncle. So in one word, what's another word for a peduncle? Maybe it has a little bit of a connotation of what its function is. A peduncle you should think of as a bridge. Yeah, big, big important bridge between different parts in the central nervous system. Okay. And on this figure, this is pretty good because I see medulla, right? So here's medulla. What's the second bump called? Pons. right? And then here's the cerebral peduncle. What are these four little guys right here? Yeah, these are the corpora quadrigemina. Corpora is plural for corpus. And then, of course, the nice arbor vitae, this pattern, which means tree of life within the cerebellum. Okay. And how does information move from the pons into the cerebellum? What kind of part of a central nervous system does it have to go through? You got to say it out loud before you can leave class. And I don't want to be here all weekend. What do we call that? It's a weird word. What do we call that connection between major parts of the brain? A peduncle. Yeah, it's a peduncle. Okay. Yeah, I don't think you use that word anywhere else except in anatomy, a peduncle. All right, so that's pretty good for central nervous system. So that was a fairly long chapter. Okay. Anybody else have another question? That was a good question, because spelling is important. Excuse me. No other questions on CNS? All right, well, let's see what I can say about PNS, which stands for peripheral nervous system. All right, so here's a nice word slide. Peripheral nervous system. Here are the pictures that we want to look at. Let's just talk about the organization of the peripheral nervous system. I don't know if I have a really good slide to show you, but peripheral nervous system, you can break down into two major components. One is sensory, one is motor. Okay? And so which way are signals going for the sensory component? Sensory component of the peripheral nervous system. Yeah, periphery into central nervous system, right? And the motor component is CNS out to the periphery. One is afferent, the other is efferent. Okay. If it's sensory, it's getting information from the superficial parts of your body. We call that the somatic region. It really means body, right? But it means from areas that are not deep inside a body cavity. Things that are deep inside of a body cavity are referred to viscera. Right, so somatic is a different area than the visceral region. So you have somatic senses and visceral senses. And the same thing for motor. You have somatic motor that goes to, what's the effector organ for the somatic motor system? Somatic means not going to a body cavity, going more to the surface of your body. You have skeletal muscle right there, right? So somatic means voluntary, going to skeletal muscle. You also have visceral, probably a better way to think of visceral, the nervous system that goes to things deep inside body cavities, is autonomic. We're going to look, that's a whole chapter by itself that we'll talk about next week, autonomic nervous system. So the effector organ for the somatic nervous system is skeletal muscle, produces a response. The effector organs of the autonomic nervous system, right, are things that you cannot control, are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. So the autonomic nervous system has three effector organs, but the somatic nervous system only has one. Right? So some are voluntary, some are involuntary. The structural organization. In the periphery, we have receptors so that we can appreciate different forms of energy like light and heat and cold, right, or chemical concentrations. Those require sensory receptors. In order to produce a response, there has to be a motor ending on a nerve to stimulate that effector organ. So there are different ways signals can get in and out of the central nervous system. There are nerves that leave the spinal cord. What do we call nerves that can enter or leave the spinal cord? I see that right here. They're called spinal nerves. And nerves that can enter or leave the cranium are called cranial nerves, right? Just by their location. You don't have to know how many spinal nerves there are. I have 31. There are about 31. But we do have to know a lot about these cranial nerves. How many cranial nerves do we have? Yeah, we've got 12, right? And bilaterally located, so you have 12 pairs, not just 12. All right, let's look at some peripheral receptors. And these are four senses. And we've talked about these already because most of these are located in the integument or different layers of the skin. And these are like receptors for touch and pressure,
All right. Anybody remember what kind of receptors are for touch and vibration or pressure? The lamellated kind. How about a Pacinian corpuscle? Is that kind of ringing a bell? Merkel's disc, Meissner's corpuscle, those kinds of things. Okay, pain. What kind of receptor produces a pain sensation? It's not fancy like a Pacinian corpuscle. It's just a free nerve ending. A free nerve ending can sense pain. And the same thing for temperature, free nerve endings. No special kind of receptor. Okay. And then there's some really special kinds of sensory organs on your body. And when we get to senses, we'll talk about these, but this would be vision, hearing, balance, taste, okay, those kinds of things. So all of these things are what we call extroreceptors because they are monitoring things that are outside our body. We also monitor things that are inside our body. We call those interoceptors. So there are things that monitor glucose concentration, and when it drops, it makes you hungry. Okay, if visceral organs are being damaged, it can produce pain, visceral pain. And visceral pain and somatic pain are very intense, but they're completely different kinds of sensations. Somatic pain is very acute. You can localize where it's coming from. Okay, visceral pain is a dull pain, but it still hurts just as bad. But you can't tell where it's coming from sometimes. As a matter of fact, maybe an organ in one part of your body feels or is sending pain signals to a different part of your body. We call that referred pain. Okay? Like when somebody has a heart attack, at least for males, when they have a heart attack, it's not their heart that hurts, it's their shoulder that hurts, right? Or left arm, or maybe their throat, for instance. Okay? That's visceral pain, visceral sensation. Lastly, proprioceptors. Proprioceptors are these kinds of things. Where is it? Okay, proprioceptors right here. Okay, I see a muscle. Do you see a muscle right here? Do you see striations? What kind of muscle does that look like? Nice skeletal muscle, right? Here's a nice tendon. There are organs in all of our muscles and all of our tendons, and they monitor the stretch, right, and tension that's produced by a muscle. And these are important because if you overstretch a muscle, it could be damaged. These sensors then will prevent overstretching. And actually, both of these will. And so these things produce a sense that we call proprioception. So if you were to close your eyes right now and I walk by and I grabbed your right hand and put it above your head, you could tell me where your hand is without even looking at it because of proprioception. All of these things are sending information. And what part of the brain is important in coordinating skeletal motion, especially if it starts to misbehave and not do what it's supposed to do? It is the, underneath the occipital lobe, it is the cerebellum. Cerebellum helps maintain that equilibrium. Okay, so proprioception, you have receptors all over the body. Okay, well, here are some other kinds of receptors. I don't think I'm going to talk about that so much, right? Chemoreceptors monitor chemicals. Thermoreceptors monitor temperature. Photoreceptors monitor light. So a lot of that stuff is pretty common. Okay, and I think we've talked about all of these already. Okay. So when we come back next time, we're going to start talking about these peripheral motor endings. And these go to, in particular, skeletal muscle. We're going to be concerned with skeletal muscle. And that is a chemical synapse. Did we talk about what's necessary to transmit information from, across a synapse? What kind of signal is it? It's a chemical signal. And that chemical signal is called a neurotransmitter. And there are a number of different kinds of neurotransmitter. One is called acetylcholine, right? Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Nope, it's up here at the front. So please sign the sign-in sheet. I'll turn some lights on before we go.